Okay, then.
So, it's warm today, but it's a little better in here in the room. Not sure it's good in here, but it's better.
It's definitely better.
All right, so I want to get on today to the systematic properties of rotation curves. We touched on that last time with flat rotation curves, which if you go to a lot of science talks, is it. People will go and say, okay, rotation curves are flat, therefore we need dark matter, and they're off and running with whatever their favorite dark matter theory is. There is more to the story than that, and it informs how we think about the problem. And these things are all interrelated and are part of whatever the final explanation is. It's not just that rotation curves are flat, but there are all these systematic properties, not all of which are distinct, but they have been discussed in different terms in the literature over the years. And it's all those different words so that you'll know what people are talking about when you pick up a paper and it comes up. Oh, there we go. So that is all of that, right? And that'll be in the notes, so you won't have to struggle to write it all down.
I left the notes.
Okay. But one is just that rotation curves are approximately flat at large R. And this behavior is persistent enough that it really could be called a natural law in the same sense that Kepler's law is, right? We talk about Kepler's laws all the time, b squared equals a cubed, which expressed in terms of a rotation curve, predicts that the velocity should fall off as 1 over the square root of r at large radii once the mass is encompassed. And that's not what galaxies do. So apparently they're playing by a different set of rules. And it is not an arbitrary set of rules. They always have, the rotation curves always have a period over which they're flat. Some go up and fall, some rise slowly. But they all have a range of radii over which they are flat for some persistent period, which has no obvious end in the data. So everybody's busily writing this down. It'll be in the notes, and I'll go back over each of these, so don't feel like you have to do that every word right now. Because you're not going to get to. Okay, so there have historically been claims to find rotation curves that are falling. Why is that important? Well, it's not a theory, it's just an observation that rotation curves are flat. But we invoke dark matter to explain that. So what would we expect for the distribution of dark matter?
It would be distributed. So the dark matter density can be constant.
Well, it could be constant, but is it going to go on forever? Should have an end, right? There should be an edge beyond which, if you could find tracers on orbits far enough out, that you ought to see a return to Keplerian behavior. This is the solution for a point source. And if you get infinitely far away from any mass distribution, it looks like a point, right? So the idea is that if you get far enough out, you should hit the edge of the halo. We don't know how that edge sits in, if it's a sudden truncation or if it tapers off in some gradual way or what. But at some point you should have encompassed most of the mass and the velocity should start to fall. We don't hardly ever observe that. So the presumption is that we just haven't observed far enough out. The dark matter halo is much larger than the extent of the luminous galaxy and tracers that we have. Now there have been a few claims over the years that rotation curves are falling. This is a famous example. DDO 154 is a famous nearby dwarf galaxy, very low mass, relatively slow rotation. There it is. No, I don't want that one yet. All right, this is going to be an issue. All right, so these blue points were published in 98 by Carrie Nolan and Purton. And they made the case that they had gotten to near the edge of the halo. This point's lower than that one, is lower than that one, and it was starting to fall. So, yay, the edge of the halo. And it made some sense that you might see the edge in this kind of galaxy, because it's a small, low-mass galaxy in the first place. So maybe that's true for the dark matter halo, too. We've gotten to the edge. On the other hand, do you see that that's a particularly persuasive case? Yeah, I didn't buy this even before the other data. Now that you see the more modern data, it doesn't do that. And so in every case where we have chased this up and gone further out, that is, there are a number of galaxies named here where people had argued that maybe the rotation curve was starting to fall. You go out and you look harder, that's never been reproduced. You look harder and it just keeps going. Yeah.
For we originally just added a potential instead of like actually thinking we about it as dark matter. If you were to keep the intensity of that potential the same and continue to take it further and further out, would it affect the way the galaxy forms?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, those are a couple things. So for every gravitational potential, there's a corresponding density distribution. So, you know, whatever potential you want to have, you have to work out what the corresponding density is. If you wanted the potential to keep going for a while, then the density has to keep going in whatever way is necessary to sustain that. So eventually, if you contain all the mass, you should go over to the point mass Keplerian type of behavior. And we just never see that. It gets hard. This is the modern data for this dwarf galaxy. You can see there's no stars here, which makes it interesting for other reasons. Very feeble stellar population. Most of the mass is in the atomic gas. But that, too, peters out at some point. The gas goes much further out than the stars. But the data get ratty when you get far enough out. And so as well as the rotation curve here, here's the inclination fit and the position angle, which twists a little bit as you go along. Right, so they fit this in a number of different ways, and Kaylee can tell you in great length all the things that can go wrong when you do this, but it's hard to get out there even with deeper data, right? And so there's a range of inclinations that are acceptable to the data, and you have to divide by sine of the inclination to get the rotation curve, and so that's the range up there. So even though the previous version looked like it was rising instead of falling, it's consistent with being flat. So there's just no clear evidence that this behavior changes, though presumptively it must. Another historically important example is NGC 3198. This is a big bright spiral galaxy nearby to us. It's one of the first that had an extended rotation curve. This is the rotation curve from Van Albada and Santisi. Note the date, in 1985. I was a senior in college in 1985, and Scott Tremaine was teaching a class on astrophysics that I took, and he said, oh, well, there's got to be dark matter, and we didn't like that. That was still a new idea, right? It wasn't taken for granted, and it sounded like a very dodgy thing to assert. So he showed us this at the time, and so you can see the rotation curve becomes flat. In this case, it rises up, falls down a little bit, and then flattens out. And you can account for much of the inner part of the rotation curve with the stars that you see. Right, so you work out what the gravitational potential is of that image, then you can predict the rotation curve on the Poisson equation, just an application of Newton's laws. And that curve is what you expect, right? So this is what the luminous stuff does, this is what the data do, and so that difference is the dark matter halo. I found that really persuasive. There's something else going on there. And that halo is, of course, the dark matter that we cannot see directly. Now note, I didn't notice this until I looked at it again today. They've kind of fudged it a little, right? The data go a long way out, but it does stop at 30 kbc. They've plotted it all the way out to 50. You don't know what's going on out there. It could do that or that. But it can't do anything radically different for a mass distribution that is nice and smooth and continuous, right? If you just truncate the halo right there, it's still got the enclosed mass, and the mass isn't, and the velocity isn't going to just drop like a stone. The most it can do is start to drop as a Keplerian right there. So it is an extrapolation, but it's not too crazy. And so it's hard, once you get a flat rotation curve, that actually puts it to a limit on the edge that is out beyond the edge of that. You can't just always have it truncated at the edge without having some effect. Okay, so rotation curves are flat. That's rule number one that is well known to everyone at this point. And it didn't occur to me to think of it in terms of the natural law until, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, after talking to a lot of people about it. But we've been behaving like it is for a long time. So, for example, in the 90s, I wrote proposals saying, we're almost to the edge of this halo, and you'd have arguments as to why that is, and you would chase up, or you'd want to chase up the galaxies and see if you could actually really find that point where it falls down, and a lot of those proposals for telescope time were rejected because, it's just going to stay flat. Right. So already in the 90s, people just assumed that this was like a law of nature. They behaved that way, even though they didn't talk about it in those terms.
Yes, wait, what to be described as a natural law, like for this scenario, like Kepler's law is still correct, right?
Yes.
It's just an additional sort of dark mass added to it.
That is the presumption that we are making. But so it's a good question. What do we mean by law of nature, right? So Kepler's law, and it actually, I've tried to look this up. The National Academy gives a definition, and it's really weak, sort of a generalized description of how nature works. Rotation curves become flat. There's a description of how things work. They don't keep going and going up. They don't start to fall down at some specific radii. They're becoming flat. And that's not consistent with Kepler's law. Presumption is that we have dark matter that makes it consistent. We just have to get far enough out to find that Keplerian depth. But, like I say, already by the 90s, the presumption was it was just going to stay flat, so why keep looking? We've been there and done that. That's just the beginning of the story, though. So the second, and I'm going to spend most of the class on this, is the Tully-Fisher relation. Of which there are many flavors and kinds, and I will try to distinguish all of those for you. But basically, bigger galaxies rotate faster. Well, big is a bad word. More massive galaxies, because it has to do with the mass of stuff and not how, what the radius is. Right. So now what I'm saying is that it's not just that rotation curves become flat, but the amplitude at which they become flat depend on the properties of the galaxy, mostly the mass that you can see. So very massive spiral galaxy like UGC 2885 here rotates very fast, about 300 kilometers per second. Whereas these dinky little dwarf galaxies, they rotate slow, 50, even 25 kilometers a second. That's very slow by galactic standards. But they all have, once you get out far enough, they all have more or less flat rotation rings. I have not seen any indication that this bottoms out at low velocities. The lowest mass rotating galaxy that we know about right now is Leo P, has a flat rotation curve of about 15 kilometers a second, so all the way down to there. There are smaller dwarf galaxies, but they're not rotationally supported, they're pressure supported, so it gets a bit complicated. And they might deviate, but they might not. At the high mass end, this seems to be about the maximum. You do not find spiral galaxies in the local universe that rotate much faster than 300 kilometers a second. Up there, but not much higher than that. And that just seems to be an upper limit to how big galaxies form, at least rotationally supported ones. At one point, Vera Rubin actually offered a prize. I forget the threshold, she said, but she asked for a disk that rotated faster than 500 kilometers a second. There's never been such a thing found. She did, however, pay it out because she failed to specify that she meant a spiral disk. Somebody found a disk of material rotating around a supermassive black hole, and it was going faster at 500 kilometers a second, and showed very nice Keplerian declines. And she'd say, okay, that's not what I meant, but fine, that's what I said. So, so there does seem to be an upper limit to how massive things are. Now, Tully and Fisher, I think people don't think of the Tully-Fisher relation in the same breath that they do flat rotation curves, just because of the history of the field, they should. That's the point here. But historically, the Tully-Fisher relation has been a tool to measure distances. And what Tully and Fisher noticed is that the line width that they got from single dish observations of things correlated with their luminosity. And remember I talked about flux integrals. If you point a single dish telescope at a galaxy and scan through in wavelength space, then you hit the redshift and you get this flux integral. The area of that corresponds to how much gas is there. But the width of it has to do with how fast the galaxy is rotating, right? One side's coming at you, the other side's going away. And so the width of this depends on how fast it's rotating. And so they noticed that the width was smaller for faint galaxies, faster for bright galaxies. And at the time, we did not, well, we were still debating what the value of the Hubble constant was. Was it 50, like Sandage said, or 100, like de Vogeler said? And they realized this would be a good distance indicator, because you could go out and measure the line width, doesn't depend on the distance. If you can calibrate this right, then that would be a predictor of the luminosity, which does depend on the distance. So this is a standard candle, and it's been used a lot that way in the literature to measure distances. One of the ways we got to the Hubble constant being somewhere in the 70s. At the time with this calibration, they got a Hubble constant of 90 that went to Sandage, who, as a referee, who said, well, that's the wrong answer. Put it in a desk drawer and forgot it. So this is ANA 1977, not APJ 1975. Okay, so when you're a referee, don't be a dick. Okay? Just because you disagree with a paper doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong. Okay. You know, you need to take it a little more seriously than that. Unfortunately, the history of science is replete with examples of individuals just behaving badly. So anyway, there is this clear correlation, and the concern for us in the context of dark matter is why? Why does that happen? Okay, it's great for the distance scale, but it's just an empirical thing. We'd like to understand physically what makes it come about. One of the things to bear in mind immediately, and I'll just put this up here. If I can think about it a little, let's just remember it. Right, so that somehow has to work out into that. Right, so now we're talking about a relation where every galaxy is going to be one point, and you have a relation built of many points, each one an individual galaxy, and the axes of that relation to start with are luminosity, and the other is some measure of the rotation velocity. So how do we measure that? The observed luminosity, well, we need to know the distance in order to calibrate this. Once we have it calibrated, we can use it to measure the distances to things further away. So let's say we go out and measure distances to a whole bunch of individual galaxies by Cepheids or tip of the Red Giant branch or something like that. Once we know the distances, it's fairly easy to transform the measured flux into a luminosity. That luminosity is traditionally measured in some passband. They're the traditional Johnson filters, BPRI, JHK. You can find those on my mags page. But they basically run blue to red through the optical spectrum and into the near infrared. And that is presumably indicative of the mass in stars. But there's also gas there that you have to measure by other means, as we've discussed, from 1 centimeter long and so on. And what mass is relevant? Is it just luminosity, or is there some underlying physical property like mass? So that's one axis. The other axis is rotation velocity. Line widths are very commonly used because they're observationally cheap. You can go out and point a radio telescope at a lot of spiral galaxies and get data like that. And the W20 is the line width at the 20% of the peak value. W50 is at the width of the 50% peak value. And those clearly have something to do with how the galaxy is rotating. You can also get a resolved rotation curve and define different measures, the flat, as I've been talking about. Or you could note, as you found in your homework, that the place where an exponential disk has its rotation curve peak is about 2.2 scale lengths. So you could say, okay, that's a physically motivated reason to pick that radius, measure the velocity there. Or you could just take the maximum velocity, or all sorts of things you could do there. It is observationally more expensive to derive such result rotation curves, so typically fewer data available to do that. Whatever you do, you have to correct for the inclination of the galaxy, right? Each galaxy is face on or edge on or somewhere in between, as seen on the sky. So you have to work out what that is in each case. And you might think about what things are not circular motions, corrections for that. And people argue about that at great length. So some things that happen when you construct a Tolle-Fisher relation in this way, you find that the relation you get depends on the band pass you measure the light in, that the slope of the relation becomes systematically steeper from bluer to redder bands. So luminosity against velocity is kind of shallow in the blue, and it gets steeper as you go to the red. That has to do with the colors of galaxies and the mass-to-light ratio of their stellar population. You also have to worry about corrections like not just extinction within our own galaxy along the Pleiadian site, but internal extinction to the galaxy. If you're looking at some very edge-on galaxy, it might have a lot of dust that's absorbing some of the light. You'll miss some fraction of it. It's a really big pain in the blue bands for highly inclined galaxies. One way is to measure things in the red bands and not include highly inclined things in your sample. You also don't want things that are face-on because you don't get any rotation signal at all, right? And you might then convert all this to mass. Presumably, there's just one, each galaxy only has one unique stellar mass, and it emits however much light it does in each of these bands. So if you can work back to what the stellar mass is, you should, in principle at least, do better by converting the luminosity and stellar mass. If you can do this estimation of the stellar mass to light ratio in a self-consistent way, then you ought to get consistent answer no matter which band you measured it in. The problem here is getting a good stellar population mass to light ratio estimate. Luminosity in any given band is nice because it's just an empirical quantity. It's what you measure for a given distance. Here you have to make some model assumption to get the mass to light ratio. And there the biggest uncertainty is what the IMF of the stars is. We have a pretty good idea what that is, but it gives you some leeway. Right. So for a galaxy like this, you get a rotation curve like that, and here's the rotation curve, definitions of the rotation measures that I say. So there's a flat level of rotation, there's the maximum seen. Here is the actual rotation speed at the radius where the mass model peaks. That's 2.2 scale lengths for a purely exponential disk. Right, so some people will use that. These galaxies should be, the star should still be contributing a lot at that point. And these are subtly different, so you will get subtly different relations depending on what you use. And I say all this, bit tedious, because people are not very clear in the literature about making that distinction. And so they'll go out and they'll measure something and say, oh, our relation is inconsistent with this other relation. And they won't necessarily think to check that they've measured this and somebody else has measured that. So just something to worry about. More generally, the big uncertainties on the luminous axis is, as I said, that the IMF and the stellar mass to light ratio for the mass, the luminosity is fairly straightforward. And then the velocity is easy. It's to use the Doppler effect to measure any of those velocities. What's hard is the corrections and getting the inclination just right. This galaxy doesn't make, even though it's got beautiful data, usually doesn't make the inclination cuts people impose for this kind of work because it's too face on. So Sinai kind of blows up in your face. So yeah, there are all sorts of things you can do. And here are a whole bunch of them, right? So V flat, V max, V at the peak. So there's that dwarf galaxy. All sorts of things going on. Some things that don't get far enough out to actually measure V flat. That happens. But I go through all that just to illustrate that it matters which one of these velocity estimators you want. So the line widths were available for all these galaxies. I went through and extracted each of these rotation measures from the resolved rotation curves, V-flat, V-peak, V-max. And you can see, for example, that V-max basically correlates with W20 very well. So this line width is just basically telling you about how fast the fastest rotation was within your resolved curve. So if it's that point, the green point, sometimes the green point happens at whatever radius, right? So if you imagine that you're, this is unresolved. So this thing is rotating and you're just scanning across it. The fastest thing is what it picks up at one edge, the other edge. So that line width W20 happens to correlate very well with Vmax. It does not correlate so well with Vflat. Alright, so down here it's okay. Here it falls off. That's because bright galaxies tend to have rotation curves that are falling, so they actually hit their maximum velocity at small radius, then decline a little bit before flattening out. And so W20 is a bit bigger than the equivalent Vflat, because it's picking up that maximum velocity. That's all there is to it. And this is a subtle effect. It doesn't matter. You get a totally official relation out of all these things. Unless you're trying to do something very precise, then it matters a lot what you're doing. So just be aware that those are the things. You can get lots and lots of these observationally, keep your lots published, but they're a sloppier tool than the resolved rotation curve. Okay, so this is a raw Tully-Fisher relation, just the H-band luminosity against the line width. This got very popular in the 80s, even the late 70s, as a way of measuring distances, because the H-band is in the near-infrared part of the spectrum. It was just being opened up into just becoming observationally accessible then. And it seemed very stable. The scatter was pretty small, didn't depend too much on dust corrections and so forth. And so there are two relations here. The gray points are a compilation by Bothan et al, 1985. This is already a well-advanced thing a long time ago. And one of the key goals for the Hubble Space Telescope was to calibrate this relation so it could be used in the distance scale. And so this is a paper doing that from Sakai et al. In 2001. That's the red points. And you can see they found basically the same answer. They had better distances, so the scatter goes down. But it's the same relation. So that's great. You can go out and measure the Hubble constant. Measure distances a long way and measure Hubble constant look way, and you get an answer of 72. That's what Sakai et al. Came from, and the answer hasn't budged. Tully has been doing this his whole career, and he's been getting 74, 75 lately. So that's what it is since the turn of the century. Okay, but why? Why does this correlation exist? That flat rotation has something to do with the dark matter, so let's see what physically is going on. So we can transform that H-band luminosity into a stellar mass by assuming some mass-to-light ratio prescription. There's some nominal prescription. I don't even remember which one I adopted. Had it through by IMF, which is okay. And so, okay, it's just the same data translated, right? If this is constant, which it nearly is in the H-band, then it's just the same relation translated, so big deal. And you can see if you double the mass to light ratio beyond that nominal model, it just moves all the points up, right? The mass gets higher. When you name the nominal one, it moves down. Half the end to L, it moves down, right? So it just slides up and down. So you haven't really gained anything, just some uncertainty in what the mass to light ratio is. Now on the other axis, one wants to be a little more precise. If one wants to be a little more precise than the line width, then you have to define something here. An obvious thing is the level of flat rotation, right? If you look at these galaxies, are they flat? Well, some galaxies are, as I've shown you. Some of them you don't observe far enough out. So so again, like with inclination, you can just specify something, it's got to be flat. Now that has the built-in assumption that if you observe this chap far enough out, it will flatten out. When make that presumption because that's what we've seen over and over and over and over again, right? We don't actually know it's true in that case until we go out and do the experiment. So, an uncertainty to bear in mind. And you can play different games with the quality, right? So here, it's getting flat, so we could run with that. The effect of loosening this criteria is to let somewhat noisier galaxies into the data, and that increases the scatter of the relation you end up with, which is fine. You just have to know what you've done. You expect that to happen. Now, another thing to be aware of and read the literature is that there are very strong selection effects in galaxy distributions. If you go and look at Sloan, it has hundreds of thousands of galaxies, which is awesome, right? This is a ridiculously huge number. You can never hope to look at them all. If you just plot up the numbers as a function of log mass, it looks something like this. And so this is 10 to the 11. There are a gazillion at 10 to the 10, already at 10 to the 9. There are very few at 10 to the 8. They're almost done. That's a selection effect. You see bright galaxies first because they're bright. And you can work through the math and figure out how far away you can see every one of these things for every one of these things and try to correct for that. But the fact is your sample is limited to the bright things. There's just always, always, always a tail of the faint things. So when you go into literature and see people talking about Tully-Fisher relation, almost always, not always, but almost always their samples are restricted to masses greater than about 10 to the 9 solar masses. The maximum mass spiral galaxy is a few times 10 to the 11. So that's it. That box is what you typically get. So that goes from about 100 kilometers a second rotation velocity up to about 300. That's the range you get. That is not the total range. There are other galaxies out there, but you have to work really hard to find them. Okay. Now, one of the things you notice when you do this is in the stellar mass relation, these low mass galaxies, once you've found them, they don't follow the same relation. Fit a straight line to that, and log space, there's a power law, right? These things fall systematically low. And it's, well, what other mass estimators are there? There's the gas mass. So you can just make a Tully-Fisher relation with the H1 luminosity instead of the stellar luminosity. It looks like crap. So that's not the right thing to do, or at least it's not a better thing to do if you want a distance indicator because the scatter is huge. So it turns out what is better in the sense of making one continuous relation is to add the two components together. So this is called the baryonic Tully-Fisher relation. So this is the baryonic mass. It's just the sum of the stars and the gas that you can see. And this restores continuity along the relation with fairly small scatter down to as low rotation velocities as we found. If you just look at the stellar mass version, there's a break around maybe 90 kilometers a second rotation velocity. But that is because these things are more gas than stars. So if you ignore the gas, you're missing a big part of the picture. You include it, you get back up there. If you go and ignore the stars, well, bright galaxies like the Milky Way are like 80% stars. So you have the same problem if you ignore the stars there. All right, so the Tully-Fisher relation fundamentally seems to be a relation between baryonic mass and the flat rotation velocity. I say the second part because if you play around using those other velocity measurements, the peak, line width, whatever, the scatter goes up. So it's cleanest, has the least scatter when you use the flat rotation velocity. And it seems to care how much mass is there. It doesn't care whether or not it's in the form of stars or gas, which makes sense, right? Why would physics care about that? Okay, but calibrating it is now really sensitive to how we've determined the M to L. So I'm just going to step through some slides that have varying mass to light ratio. And you can see it just kind of pivots. Wood.
So is it just shifting or is it changing the slope?
So now, before it was changing the slope, right? Or sorry, shifting, when we just had stars. Now we've got the gas in there. Right, this is stars plus gas. So it's kind of pivoting, the slope is changing. And the reason for that is that galaxies are systematically more stars, or massive galaxies, and low mass galaxies are more gas. Right? So these things, they don't really care too much what you adopt for the mass to light ratio because they're mostly gas. Whereas up here, it sure does matter, and so you get that kind of pivoting. Okay, so which is right, and then zero. Obviously, the stars don't weigh zero, and you can see it makes a difference. But is this better or that better? Okay, so this is the heaviest. That's sort of the nominal gas. That's half the weight. It's a quarter of the weight, and then it falls apart, right? So you might make an argument about the scatter. That's too much. That's still too much.
Half one looks
That one looks okay.
Quarter.
Looks okay. Quarters. But you accept the principle that you ought to be able to zero in on the right value by minimizing the scatter. Right? It'd be very strange if the true relation were or this one, and by picking the wrong mass to light ratio, you got a better relation. So, good. You're ahead of most of the people in the field when you reach some of the arguments you get into are so silly. Okay, the dwarf galaxies are important in two ways here. One, they extend the range, right? So this was the Tully-Fisher relation calibrated with Hubble. It only fits in the upper range here. All these galaxies are dwarfs and gas-rich dwarfs for the most part. All right, so they extend the range of the relation by a lot instead of just a couple decades in mass, you now get five. And so they probe these lower velocities, and they also give you the gas. You don't care about the stars as much down there. So you can hope to get an absolute calibration if you just can use find enough of those things where the gas dominates. Right, so the problem with these dwarf galaxies is that the data are noisy, and so you want to select them so there are things you believe. You can see the noise just by eye, and that the scatter gets bigger as you go down. And this is one of the arguments that's still ongoing. How much of that scatter is intrinsic, i.e. it's really there in the relation that this galaxy is not the same as that galaxy. And how much is it just noise in the data? You can see the error bars get bigger down here, so you would expect the scatter to go up just from that. Does that explain all of it? That's the argument. Well, the first thing you got to do is check for systematic errors, and so I flagged a bunch of galaxies here that I don't believe the inclinations of. You could get independent estimates of the inclination from the optical image and from the H1 image, and they don't agree in those cases. Okay, we probably don't know the inclinations then. Probably shouldn't trust them to calibrate this relation. So you have to worry about things like that. You also have to worry about the quality of the velocity field. So here's a spider diagram, right? There's a blue shifted side, red shifted side, nice, even isovelocity contours for this dwarf galaxy, clear rotational signal, get a nice rotation curve out of it, measure V flat. That's a good piece of data to add to the relation. And you can do this for a whole bunch of these things, but look at the velocity field. Well, it's not so great, but at least you see a gradient. Here, that one's pretty good. Gradient's clearly defined. Position angle's clearly defined. There's a gradient. Okay, those are all pretty good. Keep observing the same kinds of galaxies. What the heck? No. We have not detected rotation in these examples. Okay, so you better not try to use them, right? And the trick here is that even if these things are perfectly face on, and that's the reason that we didn't see any rotation, you go back to measuring a line width, there's always some velocity dispersion along the line of sight. So instead of a double horn profile, you'll see something like that. Right? Now that maybe is nothing more than the velocity dispersion rather than the rotation. But you can just go in and say, okay, that's W20. If that's all you did, you wouldn't know any better. Plot it on there, and that can go badly wrong. Right. Spending a whole lecture here warning you against it. There's no signal of rotation in this thing, so you can't say they're doing anything.
So those are just like blob galaxies?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. They're very low mass blobs of gas. They may have rotation that's just not inclined enough to see. It may be that they're rotating slow, that the velocity dispersion, right, they're partly pressure supported as well as rotation supported, so some combination of that. Mm-hmm. It would take a very detailed study to work out what's going on in each of those cases. And so the red points are the galaxies from this particular study for which we did detect a rotational signal. Ones I showed you first, and then the open points from the same study where we did not detect the rotational signal, the one I showed you last. But if you pretend, you can still measure a line width in this way. Here you can't measure a rotation velocity, there's just no signal to that. So here, if you had measured rotation, they fall nicely on the extrapolation of the fit from the brighter galaxies. Okay, that makes sense. Still going. If you plot the line widths now, yeah, that's true for the red galaxies, but it's not true for these things we had no signal for. So I don't know what's going on with them. They're face on, you got the inclinations wrong, but if you think about it, pretty much all the systematic effects will push you over here. All right. You're not measuring the rotation. The rotation you measure, you're not getting the inclination right. You can have a galaxy that is face on, but still looks oval, right? Orbits can have oval distortions. If you just do the usual thing, you would say that has some inclination. What inclination would it need to make it look round? And then you will get the inclination wrong in a way that pushes you over here. So this is fairly well known at this point. You ought to be careful about systematic errors pushing you off to that side. So you just have to be clean like that. And if you do that, then these relations stay pretty clean down to pretty low mass. All right, so this is I'm going to show you each of the stellar mass relation and the baryonic Tholuck relation and the gas mass relation. So the y-axis will change on each of the next couple slides. It'll be the same data, the same x-axis. On the left over there is the line width, so what you can get cheaply. Here is the flat rotation just measured from resolved rotation curve. And you can see already this regime, these things are gas dominated. If you just look at the gas, they have a perfectly decent rotation, Tholuck relation, but not so much for these things. If you put them both in, get the nice continuous relation, and that's true in both cases. So if really fills in to use both, and that's true for both relations. But if you go through the error budget, then this still has some residual scatter, that is, the measured error bars do not suffice to explain all the scatter in the data. There's a leftover about 0.2 decks. So in this case, you go through it, and all you get is an upper limit that is not greater than that, i.e. the data are consistent with zero scatter. So that's another good hint of a law of nature, isn't it? There's a perfect power law relation between these quantities, baryonic mass and flat rotation velocity. It's, the data are consistent with a perfect line there, not one of finite width. And if it is a finite width, it is negligibly small in astronomical terms. Okay, so now we can use these gas-rich things to get an absolute calibration, because they don't care how much, too much, what we assume about the mass-to-light ratio. So here's just gas mass against stellar mass, different colors for different samples. That red line is the line of equality. So there are lots of great data for brighter galaxies, but they have more stars than gas, and when you propagate the errors, this is the fractional contribution of systematic errors to the total error budget. And that systematic uncertainty is dominated by how you pick the mass-to-light ratio of the stars. So you can see for all the bright galaxies, that's the entire error budget. It's basically how you pick M to L. That's not so true for these no-mass galaxies. Now there are other systematic errors. But M to L is still the big one, and these things are mostly gas, but they're not all gas, so you do still have to pick something. But still, you can minimize the effect by picking those gas-rich galaxies, and so if you go and do that, this is the relation that you can get, and you can slice the heck out of it. Now notice, I'm only showing you the bottom half of the relation now. Most Pauli-Fisher relations are faster than 100 kilometers a second. This is just where the gas-rich galaxies live. So you're also learning something about the evolution of galaxies, is that the big ones have turned most of their gas into stars. The small ones often have not. But anyway, you can fit that, the bejeebers out of that. We've done that. You get all sorts of different fits, and you still have to worry about what the mass-to-light ratio is. So here are a bunch of different prescriptions for you, how you do that, and show that the slope that you get does not depend too much on that choice that you make. And the slope, this is still controversial, but we've done this over and over and over again. And the slope is always consistent with 4, basically. So if you just surrender and say, okay, the slope is exactly 4, then this is the normalization constant. That is, you can write an exact power law. The baryonic mass scales with the 4th power of velocity. Now that's kind of interesting to think about, because if you do that, then this thing has real physical units, right? It's solar masses. Weird units, right? But that's an actual, if the exponent, as I've written the x up there, that slope is an integer, then this constant has real physics units. If it's not, if it's just some number, then it's just some random weird relation that you put into it. And that is true. In general, if you just plot the luminous version of Pauli-Fisher, then the slope will be 3, 3.5, whatever, depends on the pass band and the range over which you fit. But whenever we make the baryonic Pauli-Fisher relation, try to calibrate it, you always get A around 50, give or take a few.
What's the difference between the baryonic and what's the other Pauli-Fisher relationship?
So the traditional Pauli-Fisher is just luminosity.
Uh-huh.
So you could make a luminous Pauli-Fisher relation.
Uh-huh.
You could make a stellar mass. Uh-huh. Might convert the luminosity to stellar mass by some sort of. You could make a gas mass Pauli-Fisher relation, which is the one that looked ugliest. or you can make a baryonic one. So. So by baryonic, I just mean the sum of the normal matter that you can see, all the stars and all the gas. And in fact, sometimes people argue that maybe the dark matter is a form of baryonic mass in the gas, say a very cold component of molecular gas. I would think it would show up as a deficit in this relation. Just the way you saw a deficit when we didn't have the H1 gas. But now we add it back in, it's a nice continuous relation. It doesn't leave a lot of room for other significant components of baryonic mass. There can be other things, right, but they're drops in the bucket by comparison. Now, when the slope is exactly 4, it's amusing to realize that this ratio of one side of that equation, I have said m goes as v flat to the 4th, this divided by Newton's constant as units of acceleration. So you can work out what the characteristic acceleration is that corresponds to that. A slope of 4 in the Tolle-Fisher plane is goes hand in hand with a characteristic acceleration scale. So you can work out what that acceleration scale. I did this at one point for that sample gas-rich galaxies. It was just over 1 meter per second per second. Times 10 to the minus 10, that's 1 angstrom per second per second. Tiny little number. Note also there's this constant 0.8 there. That's the geometric term to account for the fact that flattened disks rotate faster than the equivalent spherical distribution. Right, so if you had done that part of the homework, where you didn't just have a spherical exponential disk, but you had a flattened exponential disk, that's what that factor accounts for. It's just a geometrical term that shows up when you do anything like this. That is to say, v squared equals gm over r, but there's a constant out front of order infinity. That's what the constant is in this dimension. But it's a nice, you know, quasi-Gaussian distribution that you get from those data. And again, the data are consistent with no intrinsic scatter. That smooth line is a Gaussian with the expected width for the error bars.
And this is the acceleration of all the galaxies?
This is a characteristic acceleration defined in this way, just the ratio of E flat to baryonic mass.
Okay.
So each galaxy is one square in the histogram.
Okay.
And then the entire population has that distribution. As I say, that distribution has the width that you expect just from the errors that you see, so they're all consistent with that mean value. So that is kind of telling that there's something going on to that effect. It gets weirder than that. I did ask you to remember early on, I just said in words, all right, so v squared goes as gm over r, and yes, there can be a factor of order unity out there depending on the geometry, but this is the basic functionality. Must be true, right? This is what Newton taught us. Velocity is related to the enclosed mass and the radius. So now, here are two galaxies.
We did not have cash flow, and that's the hardest part of it.
There was no cash.
We have these two galaxies. Now I have scaled them so that they are the same physical size. This one's much further away, so its diameter really is much bigger. But it's also lower surface brightness, so when you integrate up the mass, they turn out to be pretty much the same. Okay, so given those two inputs, same mass, different radius, what should their velocities be? Same mass, so it's the same. Okay. But what about this? So you're right. The Tolle-Fisher relation teaches us that they have the same velocity. Newton teaches us it should be different. So here are the rotation curves in some detail. The higher surface brightness compact galaxy has that baryonic rotation curve, that observed rotation curve. The Newtonian prediction for the rotation curve of that stellar component is that light blue line, the green points are the actual rotation. So look, the maximum here is much higher than there, even though the mass is the same, because the radius is bigger in the low surface brightness galaxy. We have assumed that this equation is true in solving for this equation, right? We're applying Newton's laws to the observed mass distribution.
So the Tully-Fisher relation doesn't matter?
Indeed.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
So that's kind of what I was asking before, like originally it had just a potential. Does it matter how we...
Well, apparently not, but
apparently
it should.
Okay. It should.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And so, you know, and it does, so that's true at large radius, where we're talking about the Tully-Fisher velocity. At small radius, it makes a difference. So if you measure at some fixed radius, say 5 or 2 kiloparsecs, then this velocity is smaller than that one. Mm-hmm. But you get out here and it forgets. So it's as if early on, the galaxy starts off obeying this rule from Newton, and then at some point it gets far enough out, it just kind of forgets. So presumably the dark matter takes over, but it has to do so in a very specific way. All right, here's another way of illustrating that. This is Tully-Fisher again. It's now an ancient plot. But if you just use v squared equals gm over r, then each different color corresponds to each different surface brightness. So the red galaxies are the most compact, and then they go down in color to the blue ones are the most spread out. And you would expect, just by applying this, that they would form parallel Tully-Fisher relations offset by the amounts that those lines illustrate.
You know,
the data don't care. They're not listening. Didn't get the memo out there in the outskirts of the galaxy. They're all smack on the same relation. So the radius, even though you write this down, the first thing you would think is this is, if you could plot a third parameter of the radius, that would matter, and it does not. And so there's an example of the residuals. So you fit the relation, subtract off the relation, and so the y-axis here is now just the difference in velocity from the residuals. And that dotted line is what Newton would predict. Things that are more compact should be rotating faster. Things that are more spread out should be rotating slower. So just another way of showing the same thing. And there is, even though there's no residuals in velocity that we can see, there is a big range in size at a given mass. So here is what this is, size by as measured by the exponential scale length of the disk, plotted against the flat rotation velocity, which is a proxy for mass, right? That's what Tully-Fisher says. These two things correlate super well. And so at any given mass, there are galaxies that are really compact, there are galaxies that are really spread out, and yet they don't budge on Tully-Fisher. This is a puzzle. If you're looking confused, good. You should be. Tully-Fisher does not follow from this. This puzzle remains unexplained today. There are many explanations, but none of them hold water. So. All right. But observationally, this is what we got. The Baryonic-Tully-Fisher relation is fundamentally a relation between the amount of mass that is that you can see there and the amplitude of flat rotation. So it's not just the luminosity, it's not just the stars, it's not just the gas, but it's all the normal matter that is in the galaxy. Stars plus gas, which we're calling the baryonic mass. No reference there to dark matter, just what you can see. the effects of the dark matter are presumably all taken up in B flat, and that correlates more or less perfectly with the amount of mass that you can see. And it does so through to velocity, through this particular formula. So it doesn't matter what form the mass is in, as long as it's baryonic. The scatter in this relation is negligibly small. If there is an intrinsic scatter, it's so small that we cannot measure it. What scatter is seen is just what you expect from the various uncertainties in the inputs. And we don't understand where this comes from. This is a really strong physical relation. It's an integer slope, which it appears to be, and it's a good candidate for another law of nature. Like rotational curvature flat and t squared equals a cubed, m goes as v to the fourth. But we do not know why that happens. Yes?
Wait, so do you still need dark matter for something?
Well, it's a puzzle, isn't it? So on the left side, we don't at all. But the presumption is that it's the dark matter that's setting v flat. Right, so somehow the amount of dark matter and its distribution have to be entangled with those of the baryons in order to lead to this relation. But getting that right is really fine-tuned.
So yeah. They kind of have to interact kind of in a way.
That would seem like a reasonable inference. And that is not what you want to have happen in cold dark matter. Like by construction, most dark matter doesn't interact with baryons, not directly anyway. So it's hard to arrange.
But it just leads.
Well, so you get to play, think about that more on your next one. All right, well, enjoy what's left of this beautiful day. Good night.